Hello and a very warm welcome to all of you for the fourth podcast brought to you by the North of Scotland Parkinson's Research Interest Group with me, Julie Jones. So far on the pod, we've had some neurologists who have been involved in clinical research, but today we welcome Professor Tilo Kunath, who's a scientist who works at the Centre for Regenerative Medicine, which is based within the University of Edinburgh. So Tilo's work so far has focused on the last decade developing our understanding of the protein alpha-synuclein, which causes the degeneration in neurons in Parkinson's. And he and his team have been instrumental in developing our understanding of this protein and its role in the pathology of Parkinson's. But in addition to that, part of his work is focused on looking at cell-based therapy for Parkinson's and how this can potentially be used to modify the Parkinson's that we're all familiar with. So as usual, I have a number of questions at the ready to ask Tilo, which have been sent in from people who live with Parkinson's. In particular, a big thank you to Neil Morrison, who's a member of the North of Scotland Parkinson's Research Interest Group, who's contributed a large proportion of the questions for today's pod. So thank you to you, Neil. So I'm very excited to hear from Tilo all about alpha-synuclein in relation to the pathology, but also the direction that science is going to explore this protein in relation to developing interventions that may help people living with Parkinson's. I'm just going to start with a nice general question for you, Tilo. So in relation to your research, how do you think it's contributed to our understanding of Parkinson's?
Wow, that's not an easy question. It's a big question. I've been working on Parkinson's for over 10 years. And I think one of my biggest contributions at the beginning was to show that we could make stem cells from people with Parkinson's, show that it has the stem cells can be turned into neurons and have some of the characteristics of the patient disease. And in this case, this was a mutation that makes too much alpha-synuclein in the body. And we also showed that these stem cells, when they turn into neurons, make too much synuclein in the cells and then also get characteristics of Parkinson's pathology. So this was a paper over 10 years ago, but the reagents generated in that paper, meaning the stem cell lines, have contributed to over 30 papers since. So we've given them out to labs all across the world. We've been still working on them today. And this has been a mine, like a big resource for the Parkinson's community. So this is a historical contribution, but I'm gonna jump right to 2022. So our most recent contribution that we're really excited about and that we're working on very actively in the lab is again about this protein alpha-synuclein. And it's been known for over two decades that it's involved in Parkinson's pathology. But we also have evidence now that it has a protective role. It has an important function in people. And we think that role is to protect against neurons, against viruses, or against insults. And this is what this protein does in animals, in people, and in youth, is to protect against neurons, against things such as viruses, or maybe other stressors as well. But it has it's a double-edged sword, this protein, and then in some situations it can become harmful and cause things like Parkinson's. So looking at this balance between this protein, this good and bad sides of this protein, is the current body of research. And we had a paper with a virologist in Denver. His name is David Beckham. So obviously not the footballer, but David Beckham and I came out with a really exciting paper in a journal called Brain this year.
Okay, and so from that, what do you think are what are you going to take forward from that paper?
So we think that alpha-synuclein, you have to be very careful about how it's behaving inside the body. We're trying to understand if alpha-synuclein is protective. When it's protective, does it create these things called amyloid fibrils or these structures that look like Lewy bodies? And this is actually a protective mechanism. So yeah, I think we're really trying to understand now if infections and infectious agents can trigger Parkinson's, but more importantly, can it facilitate an acceleration of Parkinson's as well in people that have Parkinson's? So we think it might be important to be very careful with getting further infections. And there's a few cases already in case reports in the literature with SARS-CoV-2 precipitating what looks like a sudden onset Parkinson's. They get COVID, suddenly they have Parkinson's symptoms. But what the cases probably are is that they were on the brink of getting Parkinson's. They were maybe in a pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic stage. They got their COVID, and this just triggered them into the Parkinson's state. And it looked like it was caused by COVID, but it was just slightly, or maybe not slightly, but accelerated by it. So this connection between viruses and Parkinson's and the synuclein pathology, we think if we understand that better, we could slow Parkinson's, maybe even prevent the onset of Parkinson's. So this is where we're going now from this recent paper.
Wow, I mean, that's really exciting. I think historically we've known about the clumping of alpha-synuclein and the fact that that's almost the evil or the thing that causes Parkinson's, whereas now what you're saying is potentially it is a protective mechanism, and then something goes wrong where there's either too much or how it's laid down changes. So do you think in some ways that might help us identify people who may be at risk of developing Parkinson's sooner, or is that way too far in advance for us to think of?
Yeah, I think... connecting an infection with Parkinson's is still really difficult because the time it takes for alpha-synuclein pathology to accumulate to cause symptoms, you know, people think it's up to a decade, or maybe longer. So of symptom-free life. So if it's connected to repeated infections in the gut in your 40s and you're not getting Parkinson's until your 60s, it's hard to make that connection. But what we do know now is when alpha-synuclein starts to make these aggregates, they slowly are building up in the body in a way that could be detected by simple tests, we think now, such as saliva test, sebum test. So we have a big story with Joy Milne looking at sebum. Alpha-synuclein is not in the sebum, but the skin is definitely changing in Parkinson's. There could be signs in even the blood that the alpha-synuclein is getting a bit unusual. But one difficult thing about the blood, although alpha-synuclein is a brain protein, it's actually really highly found in blood cells for some reason. So looking at alpha-synuclein in the blood is difficult because it's already there at very high levels, to most people's surprise, because people think it's a solely brain protein, but it isn't. It's normally in the blood. It should be in the blood. So looking at changes in the blood is difficult because of this high background. But in saliva, I think the best work is coming out of looking at salivary glands, that maybe you can detect alpha-synuclein aggregates in salivary glands where it shouldn't be very early. So much earlier than the symptoms. So the infection might have been 10 years ago, but looking at salivary gland, alpha-synuclein might be found 3 or 4 years before Parkinson's manifests itself. And then the question is, can you come in with something and intervene to prevent the conversion into clinical Parkinson's with drug, with some sort of intervention, maybe exercise even. Exercising more can reduce the conversion of what we call asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic Parkinson's into symptomatic.
Wow, that's a really exciting different avenues in terms of how we could potentially use that as a biomarker or an easier test for people who are potentially at risk of Parkinson's. That is a hugely exciting area. So just when we're touching on alpha-synuclein, a number of the questions that people had asked me to put to you today, when we're talking about alpha-synuclein, perhaps in its pathological state, is there any work being done really to stop alpha-synuclein forming that causes Parkinson's?
Yes, absolutely. So, yeah, this is what people think of the simple hypothesis, you know, and there are people that are not in complete agreement that if just stopping this protein will solve Parkinson's, and some of them do have some arguments, but I think alpha-synuclein is really the major player in most of Parkinson's pathology. So lots of companies have been trying to think of ways of reducing it or getting rid of it. So I'll give you two examples. So one of them is something called antisense oligonucleotides. So this is a technology where they inject small bits of DNA-like molecules into the spine, into the spinal cord, and it reduces levels of a particular protein. So it's been working fantastic for spinal muscular atrophy. And there is some evidence it's starting to work in Huntington's. And they have made an alpha-synuclein antisense oligonucleotide, and the trials are either started or will be started soon. So this is just to reduce the levels, not to zero, because I think reducing it to zero is not a good idea because of what we think. It does have a normal function, but reducing it to slow down Parkinson's progression. So the other major effort is with antibodies. So multiple companies have developed human antibodies that can bind alpha-synuclein and reduce its levels as well. So this has been very controversial and unsuccessful for Alzheimer's, so reducing beta amyloid There have been a number of antibodies that have been clinical trials for that have not passed clinical trials. I think the major criticism and problem with these trials is that they were applied too late. So if there's already significant neurodegeneration, and reducing the plaques at this stage is not going to reverse the symptoms. But as I was mentioning earlier, if you can detect someone who's pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic or very early in the condition, you know, testing whether reduction of beta amyloid or alpha synuclein at that stage, if you prevent the conversion into clinical Parkinson's, this is where you could see this, the benefit of these types of therapies. But it's very difficult to do clinical trials with these types of people because they're not been diagnosed with a condition yet. They don't have Parkinson's, although they may be on the verge of getting Parkinson's. So it's just really a difficult thing to test and do. The third type of route for addressing alpha-synuclein is with small molecules. And there is at least one small molecule that's in clinical trials now, which I think does look promising. It has a very difficult name, but I do remember it, ANLE138B. So it's a small molecule that disrupts alpha-synuclein oligomers. It looks great on cells in animal models. It's safe to use in humans. I think the clinical trial for this is still ongoing. But this, again, has the issue of the earlier you come in with this molecule, the better. You know, by the time neurons have Lewy bodies, the structure, they're already past the point of no return. So you really need to get cells that don't quite yet have Lewy bodies, but they have these small oligomers. Can you get rid of them to prevent them from getting the Lewy bodies and then eventually dying? So timing of these therapies are really important, and they need to be in early before you need L-DOPA and the symptomatic drugs.
So it's really interesting then when you think of that in the perspective of research, is that it really highlights how we need a broad profile of different research, because for those antibodies or anti-immune medications to work, you need to be able to identify the people early, but then we also need the research to say what is the most effective and most sensitive and specific way of identifying people early. So there's several different streams of research that need to go alongside each other in parallel, because it's not going to be any one particular focus on research that's going to work. Wow, so a lot of work to be done there. So I suppose when we're thinking about, we've talked a bit about alpha-synuclein, is there any other proteins that you think could be problematic in Parkinson's, or are we thinking it's just alpha-synuclein, or is there any other new kids on the block?
There's some old kids on the block. So definitely the genetics of Parkinson's says there's a lot of genes and therefore proteins involved in Parkinson's. A lot of them converge on alpha-synuclein biology or pathobiology. So a lot of risk factors for Parkinson's are in genes involved in a type of activity called autophagy, which is a way that cells get rid of aggregated proteins or get rid of cell debris, I guess is one way to put it. So autophagy genes seem to be a risk factor. Mutations in autophagy genes seem to be a risk factor for Parkinson's. There's another very important gene called GBA, which is a very big risk factor for Parkinson's. So GBA mutations, so this is an enzyme, but these patients have very high levels of synuclein. And the autophagy risk factors also result in high levels of synuclein. So there's a lot of convergence on the same protein, even though it's very rare to have a mutation in synuclein itself. But there's a lot of pathways that lead into this protein that causes it to be misbehaving. But there's a type of Parkinson's that has alpha-synuclein has nothing to do with. So there's a young onset type of Parkinson's that is fairly common if you get it when you're young. So probably in total Parkinson's it accounts for about 5%. So these are mutations in genes involved in mitochondrial function. The three most common ones are PINK1, Parkin, and DJ1. So these have very different biology in people. So these patients don't have Lewy bodies. They don't have any alpha-synuclein problems, but they lose their dopaminergic neurons just the same. And the symptoms look just like Parkinson's. L-DOPA works. So for a clinician, these patients look the same. But at a molecular level, they have nothing to do with alpha-synuclein. So no problems with Lewy bodies, etc. And they don't go on to get dementia. They don't have the constipation problems that are common in Parkinson's. So it's a very specific motor problem that L-DOPA helps with. So this is all the alpha-synuclein therapies that I was discussing would not be helpful for these people. But it's one other part of the lab that I didn't mention at the very beginning I work on is cell transplantation. So cell transplantation would be very helpful for these people because they're essentially, they're only losing one type of their of neuron in their brain. It's a neuron that makes dopamine. And cell transplantation for these patients would be really beneficial because their Parkinson's is not as complex as a synuclein type Parkinson's, where there's the pathology and the is spreading to all parts of the body. But yeah, so this is a type of Parkinson's that has nothing to do with alpha-synuclein.
So in relation then to formation of alpha-synuclein, how does that relate to some of the potential causes of Parkinson's, thinking about environmental factors or perhaps head trauma that people, that's very much been in the press recently?
Yeah, environmental toxins can cause alpha-synuclein to aggregate. So there's a famous case from California where contaminated batch of heroin had a drug called MPTP in it. MPTP seemed to, well, it did cause what looked like sudden onset Parkinson's. And it's been subsequently used for animal models. So you can give it to mice and they also have Parkinson's symptoms. But if you give it to a mouse that doesn't have the alpha-synuclein gene, it doesn't work very well. MPTP doesn't work very well. So even though it looks like it is the drug causing the problem, but it also needs, as part of its sort of mechanism, it needs alpha-synuclein to be present in the genome because, again, the mice that don't have it, MPTP is not as effective. In terms of head trauma, yeah, so that's a really good question because certainly Alzheimer's and these types of conditions are linked to head trauma. And as you know, everyone knows very famously, Muhammad Ali had Parkinson's. So one of the ways that we make pathogenic alpha-synuclein in the lab is that we shake it very aggressively for 7 days. And then the starting alpha-synuclein is not harmful, is not pathogenic, but we put it in a shaker for 7 days and we just shake the heck out of it. And at the end of that, it's aggregated and this now becomes pathogenic. So I don't know if this is related to having your head trauma again and again and again, but we know that agitation can turn seemingly benign proteins into harmful proteins. So it's not that surprising that head trauma, repeated head trauma, can cause problems.
Yeah. Okay, now we probably touched upon this at various points with some of these questions, but somebody's particularly asked, how do you think alpha-synuclein relates to the progression of Parkinson's, but particularly the rate of progression?
That's a good question. I think maybe the GBA mutations are very telling in that. So GBA, people who have GBA mutations progress more rapidly than non-GBA carriers, but also their synuclein aggregation is also more more aggressive. And another good example actually is the cell lines we made over 10 years ago were from a family with a triplication of alpha-synuclein gene, so that they had three copies of alpha-synuclein on one of their chromosomes. But there are also a lot of duplication synuclein families out there. So they have two copies on one of the chromosomes. And the clinical history of these tens of patients, maybe even a few hundreds of patients, are really, really consistent. Triplication patients always progress faster. Their age of onset for the disease is in their 30s. Dementia by the time in their 50s. Duplication age of onset is 50s or 60s, and not all of them get dementia. So just having a little bit more alpha-synuclein in these two types of triplication versus duplication patients really clearly shows that having too much of it accelerates all the clinical aspects of Parkinson's. So, you know, this is really a reason why some of these companies just want to reduce it. So why, if you can reduce it by 50%, for example, by using one of these therapies, could you slow the progression down by the similar amount or even more, right? So I think this type of genetics is what is really pushing some of these companies to just lower alpha-synuclein. And again, I wouldn't argue to get rid of it completely because it, you know, some of it is probably needed for normal function, but having 50%, 20%, you know, just reducing it, the idea is, the simple idea is that should slow the rate of progression.
Okay. Okay. So let's think a little bit more futuristically. So what are your thoughts on what are going to be the up and coming areas within basic science when we're looking at Parkinson's? What are the new things that we're going to be looking at or hearing about in the next couple of years?
Yeah. So
or what would you like to see happening in the next couple of years?
Yeah, I think cell therapy and gene therapy are going to be really big for Parkinson's. So these are not necessarily addressing alpha-synuclein, although some of the gene therapies might. But personally, I'm very excited about how cell replacement therapy can transform how the some of the patients' lives, because everything else other than a cell therapy is all about slowing or stopping the progression. They're not about reversing the condition back to a state where you don't need L-DOPA anymore. So only cell therapy can potentially do that. So this is to rebuild the dopaminergic neurons that are lost with brand new neurons. And the cases where it has worked in the past with fetal tissue, the reversal of symptoms have been seemingly miraculous, where patients get back their functionality. They, in some cases, they get off of their L-DOPA, and it just looks, you know, unheard of. So if we, the community, the companies, the academics can get cell therapy to work, I think that'll be a huge game changer to essentially give people back their lives back, right? So back to a state where they don't need drugs anymore. It likely is not going to be for everyone. And the stage where these therapies are going to be working will also might be narrow at the beginning and hopefully expand as the therapy gets more and more tested. But I think in the next while, this is going to be something that's really different than everything that's out there at the moment. Yeah, gene therapy is also, I think, an exciting area. And maybe some gene therapies could get rid of alpha-synuclein. Some of them could increase the functionality of existing neurons. Some of them, actually, if you want to speak really futuristic, some of the gene therapies may be able to convert cells in the brain, such as astrocytes, into neurons. So therefore, there is no cells being transplanted, there's no need for immunosuppression, but converting surplus cells, such as astrocytes, and converting them into dopaminergic neurons. There's been a few papers on that already that looked really exciting, but it still looks quite far away. But I think that's going to be probably the therapy that replaces cell therapy, where you don't actually need to transplant whole physical cells, but you're going to ask the brain to convert some of the resident cells into dopaminergic neurons. It looks possible on paper, but it's still, it's hard to predict how far away that is.
Okay, so for people who aren't maybe familiar with cell therapy, what are the challenges for you as a scientist of dealing with cell therapy? What are the challenges with doing that? Because there must be problems with creating the cells, implanting the cells, growing the cells, I should imagine. It's not my area. So what are the challenges for you?
I think the hurdle that we've been most working on hardest is to convert the stem cells into transplantable dopamine-producing cells. So that transition from a stem cell to a what we call a progenitor is really hard. So we've been working on this for a long time. We've had a lot of success, and we've also been, one of our recent papers is freezing these transplantable cells. But it can go, and this is all done in the lab, prior to giving them to, at the moment we're transplanting into rats. But that part I think is really the hardest part. And if you can get that done well and have a product that is frozen and will only make dopaminergic neurons upon transplantation, that's a huge success. So other challenges about the surgery, the site to transplant are actually well worked out. I think the surgery and the site of transplantation, a lot of the groups that are working on this know that part fine. But it's all what goes into the needle, I think, is what's really important. And it has to be something that will eventually produce dopaminergic neurons within a year or two. So what you're asking your progenitor to do is to finish maturing inside a brain. And it has to be a progenitor, because if you try to transplant actual neurons, nerve cells, they don't survive transplantation. So nerve cells cannot survive the trauma of going through a needle and into a brain. But the progenitors of those neurons can. They can survive. But then we need to give them time to develop in situ, we call it. So they need to develop in the brain. And that takes at least a year. So this is another big challenge. So the clinical trial design is a huge challenge. I think the surgery, where to place the cells, and the postoperative care is well worked out. But the clinical trial design is really difficult because the cells take so long to mature. It's very different from deep brain stimulation, where you know fairly soon if the deep brain stimulation is working or not. Within days or, you know, weeks, you know if it's working. If you need to wait a year to a year and a half to know if your therapy is working, your clinical trial design is really challenging.
And I suppose then you need to wait that length of time. But what do we know about the long-term potential of cell therapy? Does the alpha-synuclein pathology then move into these new cells when we think about how it progresses? So do we know how long, you know, cells will last for, or how often they will need to be replaced? Do we know that from our animal studies yet?
We know that from human studies. Believe it or not, it seems like you read one of my papers. but since 1987, they've been transplanting. Surgeons have been transplanting fetal tissue, midbrain, dopaminergic tissue from 6 to 9 week old fetuses, and some of these have worked really well. But some of these patients have died over the years. They could see that the fetal tissue did get Parkinson's disease. They did get Lewy bodies, and the disease seemed to move into the fetal tissue at a very slow rate. It wasn't quick. So I think it was estimated that about 10 years it took for some of the pathology to move in. And by 15 years, it was really taking hold. And then there's one particular patient from the literature, his symptoms started to come back. So the Parkinson's had moved into the graft. The Lewy bodies were forming, and the graft was also then starting to fail. So one of the recent papers that we had published was we knocked out alpha-synuclein genetically in the stem cells before we turned them into neurons and tried to give them Parkinson's. So getting rid of one of the synuclein genes was enough to dramatically lower its ability to get Parkinson's. When getting rid of all of the synuclein meant that the neurons were resistant to getting Parkinson's. So we couldn't give these neurons Parkinson's. So we argued that this would be a good, we would call a disease-resistant graft. So that's being tested now by in animal models in Lund, Sweden. But now we're arguing we should just probably get rid of one of the two copies of synuclein. So reducing genetically the synuclein by 50% so that it's very slow at getting Parkinson's, but it still has some of its synuclein to carry on what we think is maybe its normal function.
Okay. So, I mean, a lot of your research is conducted within the lab, creating models. How can people with Parkinson's be involved at your level of science? And then how can they be involved in shaping research? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I have been involved a lot with Joy Milne in using this idea of a non-invasive biomarker in the sebum. The stuff we do in the lab, so all the differentiation, I think shaping the questions that we're approaching, I think could be very well informed by people with Parkinson's. But doing the actual physical lab work is even challenging for my own postdocs and students. It's really, really, really challenging work. But I think shaping the questions and addressing how we design and conduct our research, I think, is a really important thing that could be contributed by people with Parkinson's. We speak a lot with people with Parkinson's about our research, including the Edinburgh Research Interest Group. I'm always happy to chat with people with Parkinson's about the work that we're doing. There was an initiative a few years ago about people coming into the lab by Douglas Armstrong in informatics. But I think that I think the work is incredibly, incredibly challenging, incredibly technical.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting two-way street, isn't it? Because I always think for people like yourself who are doing very cellular thing, you're quite far away from the patient. And then it's nice to meet the patients that you're there for, hopefully going to be able to give a solution or a ray of hope that things are improving. But it's also lovely for them to come in and see that the groundbreaking work that's been done. So I think it's kind of self-motivating really for each party.
It's very motivating, absolutely. Yeah. I really enjoy hosting lab visits, and it was a shame it sort of petered off completely during the pandemic, but it's going to be resurrected again, and it's very motivating to the students as well. I think the students are really, really happy when people come in and they can show them some neurons or show them some cells. So absolutely.
Yeah. Excellent. So I think I've just got one last question for you, which will come as no surprise based on, for me, what are your thoughts then on the pathology of Parkinson's and perhaps alpha-synuclein and the impact of physical activity?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I mentioned previously this biological process called autophagy in getting rid of cellular junk and aggregates. So I'm convinced that exercise has lots of benefits at a molecular level for Parkinson's. So the literature that I do know is about the increase in neurotrophic factors in the brain, BDNF and GDNF. So you'll be familiar with trials where people are trying to inject GDNF and or maybe gene therapy for GDNF, but you can get it naturally with some types of exercise. But autophagy and getting rid of cellular debris is also, I think, I don't know the literature on this as well, is also increased by exercise. So at a molecular level, I think alpha-synuclein could be reduced through exercise. You know, I wouldn't be surprised at all if the evidence shows that. But this is just very specific to what I'm doing in the lab. As you know, Julian, there's tons of loads of other benefits, quality of life around exercise. So exercise is a really, really critical way to improve many aspects, I think, of Parkinson's. It's very, very effective. In addition to probably getting rid of alpha-synuclein aggregates, although I can't speak as an expert in that, but I'd be not surprised at all if it's doing that as well.
And you know, the more I learn about Parkinson's and every day is a school day, it's such a complex condition and no one thing is going to be a solution. I think, as you say, it's a combined approach. Exercise will be beneficial, but in combination with socialization and the benefits that people have coming together, and it's the same in terms of therapies, it's probably not going to be any one therapy. It's going to be a combination of therapies. And I think that's what makes it challenging, but that's also what makes it incredibly rewarding to work with the Parkinson's community.
Agreed. Absolutely agree.
Right. Well, thank you very much for your time today, Thilo. That's been superb hearing all your responses. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.